Yes, we are live. It is 9:30 here in the AM, Sunday, October 16th, 2022. Coming at you from a beautiful Belgrade, Serbia. Today's all about China. Now, it's always useful to use like a headline, current event. Everything's a process, but it's very useful to use like a headline or something like that in the news to explain what's happening. In light of recent developments. Now, China, not a sinologist, but just in terms of its position in international relations, I mean, I know a lot about its ideology, its official ideology, but that's very abstract in relationship to how the place actually functions. My brother's been there. I've never been there. So there's very little, I can say of substance about things that would really tell you more about what's going on because ideas and theories and narratives always fall much short of the real situation on the ground and what's going on in people's heads. And I'm completely ignorant about China. I don't know, what the public or whatever that means to say the public in China thinks about XJP. I have no clue. None whatsoever. I don't pretend to know. Can't say he's popular. And when I say whatever that means, the public, China is definitely more like a civilization than a country. And I wouldn't think that like the Canadian public and the American public and the Mexican public, I think those are kind of like distinct categories for reasons of difference, right? And but when you look at China, you're going to have that be within China, like that range of difference sort of ethnically, right, is within China as a multi-ethnic, multinational state. It's more like a civilizational zone. But there are things, there is a potential for knowledge about some things about China. I mean, I don't want to get too hype, I don't want to get too much like we're getting into the epistemic framework of limits to what our limits to knowledge itself is as an abstract category, but definitely there are some things we can talk about China without having even a sufficient knowledge to have an opinion about a lot of other things, like the credibility or legitimacy of the leadership or what's going on. But we can say from the outside looking in certain things like who are the major Chinese exporters, who are the major Chinese manufacturers, and what are kind of the differences going on between them. Export companies and manufacturers are tied together symbiotically in China's export-oriented economy. And the from what I can see from this outside looking in, just for whatever it's worth, which may not be very much, but here we are, I think XJP is decoupling specific export companies from specific manufacturing companies. And I think also that export companies in China work very much like the model that Patrick Byrne had with like Overstock.com, where the exporter actually pre-owns the product that they're exporting. So they're further connected than simply the logistics of export. These are volume purchasers from the manufacturer, and the volume purchasers are these export companies. Think about Alibaba and Jack Ma's model, for example, in relation to that. So it's fascinating, you know, what's going on there. It really is. And there had been, as rumors go, rumors of XJP being deposed and things like this. These come through a mix of, you know, origins, these ideas about China. Like during the time of the last American presidential election, there was buzz about the Chinese troops in Canada. Now, I guess there actually had been, but the sort of like way that it was presented, things that weren't fresh information were being presented as if this is what's happening right now in the, you know, north of the U.S. and the Chinese are about to do some fucking like shit, like that movie Red Dawn or something like that. That's the cultural reference to understand some of this China stuff. And you know, I don't think that it was very sustainable for a lot of reasons that we're seeing. The fact that China has invested in supply line security in areas of the traditional or of the thalassocratic node of sea powers on the ocean. If you look at this is primarily it's geographic, talking about the China Sea and the Spratly Islands and things like this. And Philippines is not happy about it. And they're not happy about it for a couple of reasons. One reason would be the ventriloquist part of the Philippines, which is the U.S. military interest. But then there's another voice in the Philippines, which is like a national sovereigntist voice, which not happy, not friends with the U.S. Hegemony in the Philippines, and would have liked to play sort of China and the U.S. off against each other, maybe in sort of to middle their position. And that you saw that a little bit with Duterte and things like that. But just because China invested in this kind of maritime security, this is actually a regional zone. This is not a investment in supply line security across, you know, Trans-Pacific nodes. The port of Los Angeles, you know, in Long Beach, San Pedro. Yeah, we used to go down what hill? Cherry. Man, it used to be this place we would go to. I don't remember what it was called. Down in a Signal Hill on Cherry. That was what it was. It was in the Signal Hill area. Anyway, this whole area by the port's very important. And we had mentioned that there's sauce on the there's sauce on the port authorities of the of these different important ports, especially on the left coast, and the port authorities extended time spent in China and relationships with Chinese and doing different like forums and associations and exercises, trust building, kind of organizational integration and stuff between port authorities who were, I think, just for whatever happened to be, because also you, I don't know, there's a conspiracy or just the natural flow of the region were unanimously Democrats that had Chinese, you know, Chinese Communist Party credentials. And this was weird and to a lot of people, but that's not the same thing as XJP. I think that the US, you know, ideally would have preferred for China never to develop a middle class and to remain kind of indefinitely as an export, like a lower. It's not actually China at a certain point. It wasn't its cost, but its volume and reliability and the way the supply lines had been created. But you wouldn't associate China, for example, with like just in time, JIT. You might get like Mexico or Thailand or Vietnam or something. Really Vietnam, Mexico, something like that, doing like JIT. But also you got to think of the distance. I mean, our present system of using sea lines to trade is because of the where the investment in the technology was like 3 centuries ago. And all new technologies that are introduced should always be, you know, developed upon using the technologies that exist. And you do that in, you know, for as long as those things function. You don't just declare them moribund when they're not moribund, like saying that so-called fossil fuels are moribund when they're not scarce or they're not cost prohibitive. You see what I'm saying? The primary issues relating to man's impact on because of our, you know, industrial society on the environment are more immediate in terms of like pollution of water, direct pollution of the air, like particulates and things like that, like off of factories, and then their way that they use maybe water to process things, and they get to flush into the water. The oceans are a big concern. I mean, these are, you know, any environmentalist was a rather sane person, you know, through the 90s, okay? And the thing that people get confused about is that they try to connect China to the UN Agenda 2030, and then they conflate that with the World Economic Forum Agenda 2030 or World Economic Forum's, you know, white papers and guiding documents and stuff for the UN Agenda 2030. Those are two different things. And if you look at the 17 points of, you know, the UN Agenda 2030, none of them are contentious except for point, I think, what is it, 13 or 14, whatever it is. It's the one on global warming itself. Because the implications, if following the World Economic Forum's version of it, are always the main focus of Agenda 2030 for them. You see what I'm saying? But it's only one of 17 points that really most of these, whatever, 180, 190, whatever it was, you know, UN member states, when they said, and there's no voting, by the way, here. I mean, there's no binding thing to any resolution the General Assembly passes anyway. But despite that, just so you know, there was nothing about UN Agenda 2030 through the General Assembly. This is through the different UN, the alphabet soup of different UN like subgroups and committees and stuff, like, you know, like the UNHCR, like the UN Human Rights Council or Committee or whatever, and all that, right? So all these different departments and stuff. And so, like, the working group for different countries to attend these forums, just on of the you know, diplomats, but it's not the diplomats, it's like different people from the country, not even like necessarily in the as the part of the permanent mission from that country to the UN, okay, are actually participating in the UN Agenda 2030 forum type stuff. And opposition to the cabal, and the kind of an opposition to the effects of the IMF's austerity and games and stuff, is actually within the normal talk of these countries within the framework of UN Agenda 2030. Okay, it's the World Economic Forum, okay, just like how they do within a domestic society, within a society domestically, rather, analyzing how people think in a country and then reflecting that in their, what they publish on their website, or even like in what the arguments and references that are made in books like the COVID-19, the Great Reset, or the White Book, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, the two big Schwabian books besides stakeholder capitalism. And what you have with the Chinese is they are having a crisis. They're not trying to implement the World Economic Forum stuff, and UN Agenda 2030 is all non-binding stuff. Okay, there are things that come out of different talking groups in the UN Agenda 2030 arena, and then the World Economic Forum makes its own conclusions about that, independent from any sovereign process going on inside countries through the UN framework that might participate in different forums about this, different committees, councils on different aspects of, but having that country should like worry about things like clean water and things like that, or maybe things relating to like genital mutilation in parts of Africa, women and girls, treatment of boys, prohibitions and eliminating child soldiers. So, you know, for children, child labor, also human trafficking, prostitution. These are all things that are part of UN Agenda 2030, like fighting against those things. Okay. Also, you see, so it's not just like the globalist agenda. The globalist agenda traces around this UN process, but it's external to the UN in the sense that it's the World Economic Forum, but the influence of the World Economic Forum through these UN regulated type things like the World Health Organization or the, you know, UNHCR and all these, right? The influence of like the Schwabians and the Gates and the Resetists and the Atlanticists, et cetera, all really just all one and the same at this point, okay, is profound. But none of that stuff is binding. So all this has to be understood within the framework of China's participation in the UN Agenda 2030 working groups and stuff like that. China is not suggesting that countries should reduce their CO2 emissions at consequence of economic development, which would be really, you know, almost any significant reduction. You can like tweak things here and there. You can do things, you can use different additives and different types of filters and things. You can produce maybe some, you know, 1-3% reduction or something in stasis, but then doesn't the country want to grow, develop in this way? So this can lead to very confused, and they're intended to be a bit cryptic. When the Chinese say things like, you know, that they're doing things in support of this and that. Now, with UN Agenda 2030. I'm just saying, this is not to say that China is a good guys or China is doing something good or right. None of this is coming out of my mouth, by the way. I'm just saying that there isn't a one world government or a new world order that's powerful enough that controls the events in China and the West. That's like a single thing. I'm saying that there are real divisions in the world. That's what I'm saying. And as a consequence of real divisions in the world, countries like China or like Russia may co-opt or utilize the language that comes out of the framework of these internationally kind of recognized trans or supranational or international organizations like the UN, which is in effect like the language of contemporary international relations, really. And China has certainly seized upon and popularized a trend in the West that arose that conflated how you justify what the country is doing to the people, and conflating that with how the country really understands what it's doing at the level of its think tanks and its policy, right? Like the motivations of the Crusaders may have been different from the motivations of the, you know, Crusade leading kings, right? They may have had some similar motivations, maybe some big overlapping area, but then the areas of difference, it might be small categorically, might be very large financially or otherwise. You see what I mean? So there's different reasons for things. Now, the Chinese can see, I think the rational end of things is coming out of XJP, and the cabal entrenched globalists in the CCP are those that interfaced with like Democrats in the, especially like in the port cities. You can see Pelosi dealings in Chinatown in San Francisco. Now, the thing is that some on the left might ridicule pointing that out, like, oh, you idiots, don't you understand Chinese and the American Chinatowns are like there for hundreds of years, nothing to do with the Chi-coms, and also the Chinese there probably are anti-communist. Maybe they're there because they're, you know, they left because they don't like it. It's like, yeah, well, that might have been true in the 70s or the whatever. And maybe, yeah, there's also the Chinese communities that fucking built the railroads and, you know, established the first network of laundromats. None of us would have had clean clothes without the Chinese. And so, you know, when you think about how that all comes together, yeah, they've been around in the U.S. for much longer than Chi-coms have been in China. But, I mean, it just as anecdota, I was telling you about my bartender over at the Good Luck Bar in, you know, Los Feliz, where intersection of Hollywood and Sunset Boulevard, Good Luck Bar. Owner was this old, I guess, technically Taiwanese, right? And we talking about it, and he was just, I was surprised. I just figured he would be, you know, anti-Chi-com. He was very proud of China and what China had accomplished and everything, and basically liked what the country was doing. He didn't profess to be a communist or anything like that, but just he liked what the country was doing a lot. And he was Taiwanese, but he liked what China was doing a lot. Very proud to call himself Chinese. And I know that in Los Angeles, for example, in Chinatown, you can spend the, you know, Chinese money, right? Everyone in LA has Chinese money, uses Chinese money, right? So I don't know. It's kind of weird. I know in San Francisco and LA, I mean, if you want to get like Alibaba prices with, you know, Amazon or Walmart convenience in terms of location, you just go to Chinatown and you have Chinese money. If you want like to have AliExpress plus physical location, kind of like as seen on TV stores. So the Chinese in the diaspora are very much connected to China. And those who are kind of antis, you have to understand that the Chinese secret police, you know, sent kind of neutralized a lot of, you know, anti-China Chinese or whatever, anti-Chi-com Chinese. And they have their own, just like how the U.S. has a CIA in, you know, with stations. The Chinese police and secret police have, you know, stations in different cities around the world. And the fact that the, you know, the consular offices, like the embassies and stuff, provide cover for them and stuff and create and maintain that possibility is nothing different from what the Russians do or the Americans do and stuff. Everyone's been permitted within this kind of thing to have a little bit of games. And the fact that China is doing that, okay, is not the reason that they've become powerful, but rather the reason why they're doing that is because they've become powerful. Because they've become powerful, it would actually be a dereliction of their own interest if they have the ability to have a global network of police and stuff like that. They're looking out for their own interests. Now, that's always bad when these things go corrupt or when they start taking people out or doing extrajudicial, whatever, kidnappings and assassinations. We don't really hear that a lot. I mean, at least China doesn't seem to interfere that way. They seem to just want to engage in this, you know, Ferengi kind of way. And so it's weird. But certainly there's an influence in American politics, just like we talk about in our empires and our different senators, and how these senators are all, like in any empire, the senators of the republic have entanglements, as you would say, not of the romantic type, but nevertheless, still the ones that you would want to keep discreet. And these entanglements can leave them with loyalties and with interests at odds with the national weal. So I think that with this in mind, it would be an error to view all Chinese power vectors as united on that question. In fact, the rise of XJP tends to point to the powerful presence of a whole other very powerful and increasingly dominant vector, probably had to co-opt elements of export. I think it would be too difficult to disconnect industry from export. In other words, China, despite having a Marxist-Leninist ideology, which is a futurist ideology, it's not a Pol Pot ideology, it's a futurist ideology. So maybe saying despite that is misleading. Partly because of that, and also partly because of just how the rest of the world outside of China looks, media, how people, the perception of how people live, China has embarked upon a potentially irreversible process wherein the rise of a relatively affluent and large middle class, which has already happened, but I mean that where that numerically would be larger than the poor. I don't mean impoverished, but generally speaking, the poor of China, that the middle class becomes much larger, and that means that a lot of the, say, markets that exist that are targeted towards, you know, maybe 50 or 100 million Americans who are in the game of buying things. A lot of Americans are actually not in the game of buying things. Actually look at the actual purchasing ability. Well, you might say you have 300 million Americans, but then you have to look, okay, who are the working adults? Or who are the income-receiving adults? And things like that, so it becomes much less. The market for Chinese goods, different, you know, has a limit. In Europe, Europe's about 400 or 500 million people. The U.S. is 300-something million people, and China is around 1.5 billion, roughly 1.4, whatever, 1.5. Is it more than 1.5? But in a transition to a kind of a Fordist approach, which is not export oriented, but like Henry Ford, like that the people of the society producing the things ought to have incomes that allow them to buy those things being produced. And that's really where you get this potential and affluence that's already rising. China has more millionaires than most countries have populations. And that's expected to rise. So I think when you have these big Chinese export companies, you're looking at the value of China's like export goods. It had been, you know, rising by like 7 and 10% every year, like in that decade, 2010 up, you know, onward, until recently. And then it kind of, as you hit like this 2019 thing, it kind of hits a wall and it only appreciates by a fraction of 1%, like almost not even, I think maybe 0.1 or 0.2%. So I went from about 9.5%, let's say, percent, which is about, I don't know, 2.3 trillion would have been like in 2015. All right. There had been a slowdown in the supply line and the lockdowns and stuff in 2020. This was a huge thing. And it actually works for China, at least XJP. The whole COVID hysteria, it works. This catastrophe is working very well to manage an inflection point in Chinese society where they can create the social paranoia and hysteria about COVID, okay, as a means to justify this narrative that the old export model is untenable. And so I see the Belt and Road Initiative as a way of trying to keep the vested institutional interests in Chinese vectors of power, like its export industry, which is in so many ways just overly integrated with the production side of Chinese power. Of course, we're not mentioning the military and the military industry, like the military-owned companies. That's another vector in Chinese power. The PLA and the CP are, in the way we think of it, on the administrative side, and not like how everyone's a party, but the administrative CP in the state and the military, like the PLA, are also different institutions in China. I mean, they're distinct. You know, you can be powerful in one and not powerful in the other. You see what I mean? That's what makes them, that's how you know they can be distinct. Self-describing as distinct is not a sufficient criteria. You may have motivations to describe yourself that way. So China can see these long-term problems primarily that they knew that this day would come someday. But just because you know the day is going to come someday doesn't mean that the people who got rich during this process, you know, before that day had come, even if they understand or could understand intellectually, their class interest and their money flow interest is totally at odds with that realization. They're not going to just submit to changes in Chinese foreign policy or things like wages and salaries. Like the general trend in China right now is for wages and salaries to go up. And that's at odds with the export model because of the way that has distorted price of goods, price of labor, the artificial valuing of their own currency. You know, they've kept it right size relative to actually the U.S. policy of declaring itself a stronger currency than it actually was. So the Chinese currency, you could say that they've made their currency appear weaker, but it's really this is more of a matter of perspective. Every sovereign country has a monetary policy, you know. It's all distorted. Both sides both sides play games with the value of their currency to take advantage of where they are in the buying and selling end of things, right? Naturally. But that distortion in China is not good because There's too much of a focus for trying to be competitive on lowering wages relative to growth. So in other words, in many ways of thinking that have made sense to me, generally wages should rise with GDP in a almost a one-to-one way. So even though, of course, in China wages have risen and GDP has risen, so at least the arrow of correlation is going the same way, but that rate in China is not good enough. That rate of growth of wages or incomes relative to GDP is not where it should be. And this is fertile ground for social discontent. And it also, the general rise of GDP, even though we haven't seen a matched rise in salaries at the same rate, the wealthy of China have become indeed wealthier at that phenomenal rate of overall GDP growth. So there's a growing class antagonism in China and a growing wealth inequality issue in China that could be resolved more readily by unwinding from a maritime supply line driven concept of an export economy. So to keep them together, to keep the industry, the production and industries, and to keep also the export companies on the same page as much as possible, so that you can divide those aspects of the export. You want to divide the export companies between the ones that can be transitioned to Belt and Road, that can be transitioned to a land-based export model on rail, which, by the way, if you want to get just in time, you can travel at fucking like 15 knots or 30 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour, whatever, or you can travel at 200 and 300 miles an hour. But nothing has been researched or developed that could be implemented today to get those ocean liners that, you know, the export big vessels to travel anywhere like 100, 200 miles an hour. So the Belt and Road Initiative solves, it kind of kills two birds with one stone, and it kicks a problem down the road a little bit by transitioning export companies into a different footing, which still allows them to keep their relationships intact and keeps their relevance and their money flows in order. And the dissent has been significant, and the pushback, okay? And these are like the export stuff, and it can be electronics, microchip stuff, whatever, all right? And remember, Trump signed that executive order about members in government having investments in this stuff, or a general executive order which applied to members in government. Or I have to look at the language again, but. And then you have the other day, kind of lining up with to kind of flex and influence some push against XJP, you had Biden kind of use that or implement some furthering of that to time it up with this big day in China, where the CPC will basically green light a third term for this guy, for XJP. And this is unorthodox. But I mean, things since the 90s, China, there's nothing orthodox about China. They've changed. They've changed their system. They had a chairman, a general secretary, president. But a third term was not what was the possibility for one was not, I think, initially encouraged. May be there legally, but I think maybe that something had to change legally for that to be the case. So there's controversy around that. And there, I think, were hopes that between that controversy and those in the Chinese communists who are the globalists committed to the export economy and the continued impoverishment of the Chinese people, and we're against the rapid growth of the middle class. And those are the ones that interface with the Schwabians and so forth. And they're a powerful, you know, force in China. And they were in power before XJP came. I mean, why not? How? I mean, it's not a conspiracy. It's very natural. I mean, the export economy of China was everything, you know, in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and the first half of the last decade. You know, so the question would actually be how not, you know, instead of how so, that the globalists in the Chinese Communist Party were in power, but not just such globalist policies on the export. The surrender of the national sovereignty itself was not on the agenda. That was never a nut that the Western powers have been able to crack. Not since the Chinese society rebuilt. It's been too recent. There's been a recent rotation of elites in China, and the memory is quite recent. This is just sort of like with the World War II period. And there's not a strong view that they're in a position of such luxury of power in relative position to the world that they can sell things, you know, they can sell off their national wealth. So even the globalists in China were not selling off China. They were just integrated, we should say, into the globalization networks. So basically, in a nutshell, XJP represents a turn away from globalization, but not a dramatic and sudden one, but because everyone concerned about what's going on can see kind of like which way things are going and where things ultimately go, the hysteria and the concern, the pushback within Chinese power vectors was quite a strong histamine response and quite a very powerful response against XJP from the cabal in China, despite that the changes he proposes are like over a period of like 10 and 15 and 20 years and so forth. So, because they see which way it will go. I don't know if what XJP proposes is like more stable or less stable or more viable or less viable, but certainly like, it's not just about stability or instability within China, but also the drying up, because the Western power to purchase has been a largely debt-driven phenomenon. And now that, I guess, sort of the bluff has been collectively called, and it's hard, the Americans, you know, it's hard for them to show their hand. And by not kind of showing your hand, you kind of show your hand, right? So who knows how much gold there's really there, and the Fed was never audited. All of these things going on, the lack of confidence globally, it's really just gunboat diplomacy that has forced countries to buy debt. And it's not so much that the kind of the debt issue is largely misunderstood in terms of the debt. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, if you owe me $1 million, you know, I own you. But if you owe me $1 trillion, you know, you own me. So the levels of debt are actually more like a shakedown thing. It was more like a shakedown than it's not debt. It's like, you got to lend me some money right now. I need you to lend me some money right now. And so come on, hand it over. That's actually the U.S. debt. It's only recorded like on paper so that internationally people think that they're lending to the U.S. when the U.S. has just been taking it with no intention of returning it. So it's particularly weird. It's not, it just becomes a bizarre talking point for whoever in the U.S. talks about it to be like, and we're in our national debt. It's like, no, don't worry about that. That's not the debt you should worry about. The debt you should worry about is the individual consumer debt, your personal cattle, you know, cow sheep relationship with the banks that own you directly. And they're, and your social credit score that you've already had for a long time, called an Equifax, you know, FICA score, and a LinkedIn account and a Facebook account to get a job, or to rent a house or to buy a house. That's all social credit, by the way. So it's strange to make an American phenomenon, which the Chinese adopted, into a Chinese phenomenon that we're turning into. That's not the process I see happening at all. And it kind of does this thing of, I mean, it can have a positive influence, like blaming it on China can be positive because people tend to want to anthropomorphize things that they're against, and people are not against themselves. So you want to anthropomorphize the thing you're against into being other people, but then you start othering the fucking Chinese. Maybe, you know, the problem with othering people is sometimes those people can fight back. Another problem with othering people when it's China is that they're guaranteed to fight back. So I think it's probably best to like chill out on the whole China fixation in terms of social credit, because what American politicians and corporations are implementing in the West, you know, is they're implementing it like not because the Chinese told them to, not because the Chinese pioneered the subject, not because they want to be like China. This is the natural logical outgrowth of already having a social credit score on Facebook that you don't know. You can't even know what gives you points. Do you want to have a system that is, so you want no system at all, and I'm with you, okay? But now think about the system, right? Now, I know you don't want to wear a sweater, but do you want a green sweater or a blue sweater today? So if you look at that issue of the social credit, do you want it to be a score that you know, or do you want it to be a Kafkaesque system where you just are totally silenced, completely paralyzed because you never know what's a community standards violation? See what I'm saying? I would have preferred on Facebook if I had like 100 points, maybe in a month or in a year or whatever. And, you know, if I put a meme of a Hezbollah or something, then I lose 40 points. You see what I'm saying? Or however, I mean, just for instance, instead of just no fucking reason why. That's a far greater danger than, you know, having laws that with no accountability is a far greater danger than having a Hammurabi's code, you know, posted. You always want the code to be posted. I mean, versus not posted. Now, what the rules are and who gets to put them there is the process of government. So if we've just outsourced government to corporations, and if we use libertarian talking points along the way to get there, then we're fucking morons. I'm not blaming libertarians. I said libertarian talking points. Because that's what these corporations did. They're like, no infringement on our market activities as a monopoly. Anywho, so China's no stranger to monopoly, and a lot of these monopoly issues in power led to this kind of wrestling match you see underway. And the export reliance is, I think, the big issue. And that XJP comes out from today as still leading China is a pretty strong mandate. Is a pretty strong sign of a mandate, rather, that the reform process, again, to basically account for and to redirect in terms of globalization. And I think also Democrats were always trying to reapproach. Mind you, this is a relationship that was made possible by Kissinger and Nixon, okay? And these relationships, you know, talking about with the American senators and oligarchs, right? The Chinese now also have a question over Russia, and there had always been this desire of those in the West who today have the relationships with China and their personal financial interest and the corruption, the bribery is with these export companies and manufacturers. And or the export companies. Okay, that's where all the crime is happening with the Bidens and the and any Americans that are trying to get in. And it can be confusing in the information war because people like Soros or people who talk game on investment, capital investment, always talk up China. And they're kind of doing a gargoyle effect. They're kind of making you think that their investment in China is significant in China's economy or has bought them a place at the table of decision-making in China. That's what they're trying to actually project by doing that, which is a false, that's just normal bullshitting. That's normal talking your book. That's normal posturing, right? Oh, yeah. I'm not part of it. I invented it. What are you talking about? Okay. They're just doing them. But that causes a strange reaction in the kind of anti-China confusion in anti-China politics in the U.S. because it makes it think that it, you know, something other than what it is. Then they make you think that the Chinese, they're actually making you think that the Chinese work for the globalists, you see. Remember, they tried to do the same thing with, they tried to say Putin. Remember when Schwab either misspoke, but probably how convenient to have misspoken. How convenient to like when people are always having accidents, but they keep falling on large heaps of money. Oh, I didn't. Oh, I'm sorry, man. It didn't work out for you. Like, yeah, I don't know how I got rich, but you know, sorry, what happened to you? I'm always careful of people who trip over themselves into piles of cash. So the Chinese are just human beings, you know what I'm saying? And they have these different, and I know the culture is different, and kind of attitude towards life and all those things is hugely different. Practical life questions are hugely different. We're not all the same. You know, human beings are not all the same in that sense. Cultures are really different because it's kind of like just the things that you see as a foreigner is like the tip of the iceberg. There's like a deep culture are deeply different. It's not, people think the culture difference are just the things, the tip of the iceberg, and that, but deep inside we're all the same. It's like, well, yes and no, you know, yes and no, yes and no. It would suck to live in a world that only had like one type of bird or one type of dog or one type of tree. Imagine that, like walking the whole planet, just seeing like one type of music. Every station, anywhere on Earth, just like one type of music. Or genre or whatever, or type, one type, one culture type of music, let's say. Yeah, so I think it can be difficult for people to separate those things. And I see it a lot, but it doesn't bother me personally. But it's just worth noting that it's out there, and I can see how they do that. Because as we said, Schwab, I guess with the point we were finishing, was that Schwab said, oh, Putin was a young global leader or whatever. The YGL wasn't established until Putin was like 50 fucking years old or 48 years old or something. Like, it's like, this is a process, this is a different thing, dude. I don't know what you're talking about. I think the guy who had already established the FSB in 99 or something, 2000. I think it was established the right as they pushed into as the Russians went into Yugoslavia to defend the Serbs, right at the end of Yeltsin. But Putin was kind of already in power before he was officially in power at the end of that year. That was like the June right before the end of that year. So he was already, Putin was already, that was just right when Putin came in. It was like the first thing that they did was go into Serbia immediately, Russian paratroopers. And that's the day the bombing stopped. Do people know that? Do people know why the U.S. do people fucking know why the U.S. bombing of Belgrade stopped? Like when it stopped? Because the Russian paratroopers arrived in Belgrade. And the way Putin framed it, well, I guess Yeltsin framed it, was that this was a friendly force. That this was to like help the Americans coordinate the outcome with their partners. And remember, the Americans bombed the, and this was Clinton. They hit the Chinese, the CGTN building on purpose. They hit the Chinese on purpose. Because the Chinese opposed the globalist attack on Yugoslavia. Remember that too? So, yes, there's many things about China that don't smell like globalism to me. I just don't know enough about the culture or the people or the society to want to live there or to like want to live under a system like that, because I don't know what it's like when you're in it, or how different it is or not, or how much the difference are going to be those cultural differences that are way beneath the surface. We might interpret those as being the outcome of just political or organizational differences. You know, maybe it's the other way around. Maybe in all these societies, maybe all the governmental forms are just like expressions of the deep, more deep layers of culture, right? Because obviously, like the Chinese expression of Marxism is so different from the Russian that you're like, maybe the Marxism thing wasn't that big of a factor in the cultures there. So anyway, but as I think in summary, with China, we can say that what's happening is a big event, and I think this is a referendum effectively on the path that they've been on. And I'm not saying that this is a good path or a bad path. I just am trying to describe the path to you, and it certainly means that the Western powers who had hoped that the relationship with China and the threat of a supply line cut off from China and stuff like that, and the global slowdown, which was probably going to happen anyway, you know, because of the nature of the monetary policy and where the how the US was generating money to buy imports in the first place was through selling debt for primarily to the country, like China and Japan, were like the one and two owners of, or like T-bonds, right? So shit like that. So what are we really doing if they're buying those and we have no intention to pay to they have no intention to turn those in for money. We have no intention of honoring them. So then look at the actual balance of US-Japan trade, adding to that their unredeemable coupons or whatever, see treasury bonds. It's just an interesting perspective. So I think it changes the equation very much. But what we're trying to say is that things that were going to happen kind of anyway, once you think about it, the way that our corrupt American oligarchs slash senators who interact with the Chinese, primarily like the export aspect, export industrial, and tech, right? That's export, though. Microchips, all that. While they would have hoped that things would have been different, they continue on, of course, the relationship, which has an influence on things going on generally, of course. That's the nature of corruption. But their buy-in is not with the with XJP and the way that things have been going. In many ways now you can see that some of the, you know, Soros, Buffett, and general talking points on China is about showing, you know, even if they're also hedging their own shit, but they're not saying they're going to control China. They're just be like, once this shit collapses over here, we'll have like migrated our monies over into this, but it's not going to be a significant part of China, because you can't. The thing with power, and we talked about this in our previous discussions and on record about the survivalism and actually like what happens with things like money, what happens with things like, right, when you have a breakdown in society, or even if just the law suddenly changed is another way that you could have these kind of breaks. In other words, all these Western so-called investors, or so-called Western so-called investors into this into China, the Chinese could fucking expropriate them. The only way that they wouldn't get expropriated, in fact, is if China was still engaged in some large kind of confidence building time period, you know, before. See, countries can always fake a fucking policy change and make it look like a fucking inter elite fight, and then do things and go after the people that were their friends, you know, that were foreign or investors or whatever, and just expropriate things, even though it's just a scheme from within, from, you know, everyone against the foreigners or whatever, you see, like a con, and some, you know, good cop, bad cop. So don't think of China as a monolithic power. Don't think of the Communist Party as a single organization. You can call it, people can always call things whatever they want, but it's always the real differences, dynamics, and complexities of a society that determine the different, like, factions and power groups and vectors of power in a given society. Not the nominal, not the official, you know, the de facto power is always like the real power, even if it doesn't line up with the de jure or de jure. De jure is of the day. All right, China. So that's been on China. I never send greetings to you in a personal way, by the way, especially not while I'm live streaming. That'd be quite a feat. Those are some Indians, con artists, Indians, dots, not feathers. Indian con artists contacting you to, you know, whatever, send you their money. But it's not me. I only do the Patreon and some forum moderators and myself might interact with you if you've expressed interest. That's it. What else can we say? I think that's the show. My son's losing his shit. I got to tend to him. Peace. I'm out.